Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Today, we will be starting our third teaching in Evidence and Answers 2025 conference series entitled, Can We Believe in the Bible? Is the Exodus fact or fiction? Most Old Testament scholars believe the Exodus is folklore because they allege that there is no archaeological evidence. Is there evidence for the Exodus? Discover how the right date and the right Pharaoh present a strong case for the historicity of the Exodus. Now let's get right into part one of the third message in this series with a three-part study entitled The Pharaoh of Exodus. Biblical archaeologist Dr. Stephen Collins shares how we discover who the Pharaoh of the Exodus was.
All right, we're going to talk about something that is another one of my sort of pet research projects, and that is, who's the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Now, I have a book back there on the table called Let My People Go. The subtitle is Using Historical Synchronisms to Identify the Pharaoh of the Exodus. You need that book. It will clarify everything you need to know about this subject. It's very detailed. It's not written as a popular book or narrative. It's pretty stiff, academic, documented stuff. If you have insomnia, take it to bed with you. Try to read a page a night, and you'll be out pretty quick. But I'm hearing by more and more scholars, and by the way, books and papers now are being written on it. And so people are starting to get the idea. But here's why I did it. Even amongst evangelical scholars, archaeologists, there is a 200-year span of time in which they have suggested the Exodus. Can you imagine? And that goes from the mid-15th century, that's the typical 1446 BC date that some people put on it. That's called the early date for the Exodus. And then there's that late date about 200 years later in the middle of the 13th century BC. So all the way from the reign of Thutmose III in the 15th century BC, all the way down to the time of Ramesses the Great in the 13th century BC, and virtually everything in between, these pharaohs, these time frames have been suggested for the time of the Exodus. The most popular of all these views among scholars is the late date in the 13th century during the reign of, I always say during the reign of Yul Brynner. You see the movie? Yeah. But it always bothered me. And this is a pivotal event, folks. I mean, it's big, right? This is all the Old and New Testament looks back to the Exodus as sort of that big peg, historical peg that everything flows from. Remember when you were in the land of Egypt? And I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And even in the New Testament, it refers to these kinds of things, uses them as metaphors for our faith. I've delivered you, and the Passover, and all of that. So it comes out of the Exodus. So this is very important stuff. And it always bugged me that, well, then, I mean, I can understand it if it's like Catholics versus Protestants or something, you know, if there's some fundamental. No, amongst conservative evangelical scholars, there's this vast difference. Most of them are late date. A few are early date. And virtually nobody in the middle. In fact, I think I'm the first one to pop up in the middle. But it bothered me because I thought, wait a minute. There's a lot of information there. There's a lot going on there. I mean, 10 plagues, good grief, that's bad enough. That ought to be in the historical record. Where do we see that? Something ought to be there. Why can't we get scholars to agree on who's the Pharaoh of the Exodus? And then I discovered something. After I had read every single book ever written, every paper, everything on the Pharaoh of the Exodus, I discovered something. Not a single scholar who had ever written about the Pharaoh of the Exodus had ever asked the correct question. It bugs me when scholars don't do that, because if you're going to do research, if you're going to try to find things out, you better be a good question asker. You better ask the relevant, correct question, or you will not find the answer. And the relevant question I'm going to bring up in this presentation. And there is just one question about that. But it really bothered me that they didn't ask the question. And all they were doing was number crunching. Here's how they did it. By the way, there's a high, middle, and low Egyptian chronology. And at any point, the high and the low chronology are about 30 years apart, which is, you know, a few thousand years ago. What's 30 years, right? And so it's not a big deal, but there's some high chronology, middle chronology, low chronology. And so, for example, the end of Thutmose III's reign might be 1450, but the low one might be 1420, and there'd be one in the middle. So what's the difference? Now, so what you would do, here's how you would do it if you're a Bible guy. You would say, I pick my favorite Egyptian chronology. Pick the high, middle, or low. Pick one. Then I pick my favorite biblical chronology. Well, those who are the early date guys, like 1446, W.F. Albright, and the late date guys, they look at that 480 years in 1 Kings 6:1. Remember, it says that Solomon, in the fourth year of his reign, began to build the temple 480 years after the Israelites came out of Egypt. And so he said, well, that 480 years is 12 times 40, right? 12 times 40, 480. That's a numerical symbolism for 12 generations. So 40 is an honorific generation. How long is a real generation? About 25. Until you have your kids grow up, have kids. Okay, so about 25. So W.F. Albright said, wait a minute. This is a numerical formula. This is not literal. This is a numerical formula. And so he said 12 times 40 is 480, but if we look at the real generations, 12 real generations is more like 300 years. So he goes 300 years back into the reign of Ramses the Great, Yul Brynner, and there you have the Pharaoh of the Exodus. That's how he did that. But what kind of procedure is this? It's not good exegesis, and it's not good history making. It's just not good at all, because it's just picking and choosing what you like. Well, you're not even dealing with the reasons why there's a high, middle, and low Egyptian chronology. You're not even dealing with why there's a high, middle, and low biblical chronology. And so look at the combinations there. Look at the combinations. What if you pick a high Egyptian chronology and a low biblical chronology, or high biblical chronology and a low Egyptian chronology? I mean, it's just all messed up. And so it can be way far apart. And if you just go, if you're just 30 years off from the next guy, that could be one or two pharaohs difference. So I said, going to start from scratch by asking the right question. And by the way, there's the book. All right. So you find the Pharaoh of the Exodus by asking the right question. Here it is. And this is, you've got to lock in on this. If all of those terrible events that were associated with the Exodus actually happened, as the Bible describes them, what would have happened to Egypt? I mean, if you took those things and sort of scaled them up for any kingdom in the history of the world, and if those things happened to the United States of America, all that stuff, what would happen? Wouldn't fare very well, would it? I mean, those are terrible things. 10 plagues. Well, let's look at them. Here they are. 10 plagues. To answer that question, you got to study the history of the 18th dynasty. And aren't you really excited that we're going to cover today the entire history of the 18th dynasty of Egypt? I mean, you are not going to sleep tonight. You're going to be so excited. You're going to keep thinking about it all night long. But this is it. We're going to show you that the great collapse of the 18th dynasty actually can be tied to the Exodus of Egypt. And so here's the history of the 18th dynasty. Now, here's how we're going to do this. And I've shortened this up today. I have a whole bunch of this that I do, but I've consolidated it down. Here are the power rankings. Now, why power rankings? If you're going to rank a pharaoh, how powerful is a particular pharaoh? How do you do that? I mean, do we have like J.D. Power pharaoh rankings? Something? No. You have to look at something else. The thing about the 18th dynasty is, and the reason I'm going to pick, you'll see why I pick it, not the 19th dynasty. The reason is because each pharaoh is trying to build an empire. Egypt never had an empire prior to the 18th dynasty. They just hung out in Egypt. They stayed there. But in the 18th dynasty, they pushed out and grabbed all the territory all the way up to the Euphrates River. Egypt expanded out of its borders to control everything that we know today as area of Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. All that area controlled by Egypt in the 18th dynasty. So the power ranking is how solid of a hold did any given pharaoh have on that territory? If they had sort of a minor hold, then I give them a low rank. If they had major ironclad control over that region, then I give them a real high ranking. And so this whole thing we're going to see right now juxtaposes each pharaoh in order through the 18th dynasty and where they rank in their empire building or the control of what has now become the Egyptian empire. Now, here's the Near East, and we have the Hyksos. Anybody heard of the Hyksos? Who are these people? These are Asiatic Semitic people, Canaanites from Canaan, who for various reasons wound up, a whole bunch of them migrated into Lower Egypt. By the way, isn't it confusing that Upper Egypt is in the south and Lower Egypt is in the north? That always bugs me because they're not going by, you know, we think of north as up. No, it's going by the flow of the Nile, which flows from south in Africa, north into the Mediterranean. So Upper Egypt is upriver and Lower Egypt is downriver. So they took over Lower Egypt. In fact, one day they woke up, one morning, I think, 3 a.m. It always happens at 3 a.m., right? And they said, wait a minute, there's like 10 of us for every one native Egyptian. Why are they in control and we're not? I mean, it had to go something like that. Well, guess what? Next day, the Hyksos decided to take over. They took control of Egypt, and they controlled it for the next 150 years. Do you think that sat well with the Egyptians? That they had their whole, half their kingdom ripped away from them, being ruled by foreign rulers? The word Hyksos means rulers of foreign lands. And the Thebans were just down there in Thebes, just fuming. For about 150 years, wanting to get rid of these people, and finally they did. So we're going to see that. But here's the Hyksos, and there's the Theban kingdom. Goes off the chart down there, but it's down to the south. And up there in the top, we have a kingdom you may have never heard of. What's really fun is I do this in Bible colleges and schools and seminaries and all these Bible scholars, and I show Mitanni, and they've never heard of it, which immediately tells me they've never studied the ancient Near East, because Mitanni's a big deal, and they invented the chariot. Those people. Okay. Well, here's Mitanni kingdom in the north. Mostly they control the area of northern Mesopotamia over to the Mediterranean coast. Okay? That's their area. And then we have another kingdom down there, Assyria. You've heard of them from the Bible. But at this time in history, this goes all the way back to the Middle Bronze Age, in fact. At this time in history, Assyria is a vassal state of Mitanni, of the Mitanni kingdom. And then there's another player in the region, Hatti, the Hittites. Pat mentioned those. The Hittites, the kingdom of Het. In the Bible, Hittites are called, in the Hebrew, they're just sons of or men of Het, Hat or Hatti, the Hittites. And so here they are. And look how they are kind of landlocked up there in the high plateaus of central Anatolia. And they don't like it, by the way. They want access to the Mediterranean because where's all the money? The sea trade, the Mediterranean trade. They want access to those northern coastal cities, but they can't get it because who's controlling it? Mitanni. Mitanni has it locked down all the way to the Mediterranean coast. So you can see that the Hittites are up there growing, getting stronger, but living in a lot of frustration because they can't access the world trade. They can only do that. By the way, why didn't they just go south, straight south to the Mediterranean? Because there's a huge mountain, Taurus mountain range there, and it's full of wild-eyed, crazy barbarians, and fearsome barbarians, and they couldn't do that. You can't go through the mountains to establish any kind of a trade route because of these fearsome tribes there. So they're just landlocked. They're just stuck with the Black Sea up there. And what do you got in the Black Sea? Not much. So they're frustrated. So this sets the tone. By the way, the Hyksos period is the time of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. The Pharaoh that Joseph went to visit in Egypt is a Canaanite guy. He's an Amorite guy, just like him. It's like Abraham. When Joseph comes in and works for this, becomes second only to Pharaoh in Egypt, what Pharaoh is it? It's a Hyksos Pharaoh. It's the last reigning Hyksos Pharaoh, probably. So, and not only that, how do we know that Joseph belongs during the Hyksos period? Because the Hyksos brought the chariot to Egypt. And there's no chariots in Egypt prior to the Hyksos period. That's just a fact. So, Joseph is introduced to the Egyptian population. How? By riding second chariot to the Pharaoh himself. So they rode through the land, announcing the vizier of Egypt. Here's the new vizier, Joseph, second in command. All right, well, here's the situation that was we're starting out. This is around, as the situation existed around 1600 BC, or maybe even the early 1500s BC in the time of Joseph. Now, also want to show you the power rankings of the kingdoms. Later we're going to do the power rankings of the pharaohs, as I showed you. But I want to show you these kingdoms. Number one power, the Hyksos Egyptians. And they control everything up into Canaan. See, the kingdom goes right up into Canaan. Number two, Mitanni. Number three, the Hittites. And number four, Assyria. That's the power rankings in that order. Now we're going to have the first pharaoh. Who we got? Amenhotep the first. How did we get him? Okay, Akhmose. Why is he important? Because he is the pharaoh who kicked the Hyksos out of Egypt. He finally, by the way, the archaeology here is so much fun. The previous king, the last king of the 17th dynasty, had tried to kick the Hyksos out of Egypt, and his mummy has a big sickle sword gash in his skull. Okay? Didn't work. They got him. It didn't work. But Akhmose was the first Egyptian pharaoh, and he starts a new dynasty. He kicks the Hyksos out of Egypt. He reunites Upper and Lower Egypt and starts to build the great Egyptian kingdom again. And so in this time, we still have Mitanni as number two, and then we have something else, the next pharaoh. And we're going to go through these pretty quickly. Don't worry about what's on the screen. Don't try to read all of that. I'll just kind of tell you what's happening. This is an old army buddy. This is not son. This is not son of Akhmose. This is army buddy. So Akhmose is putting the kingdom together. And so Amenhotep is doing the same thing. He's trying to put stuff back together. He's got to get what the Hyksos had controlled back under the economy of Egypt. And all that's got to be worked out. So he's just building. He's just building, building. And so all good things come to an end. He dies. And then we get Thutmose the first. Now, this is another army buddy. He gets to take it. This is not the son of the previous pharaoh. This is just another army buddy. And he takes over as pharaoh. But things are stable by now. Things are stable. The kingdom's back together. The army's back together. The wealth is flowing. Everything's great. And I think one morning, it's always 3 a.m., he's lying on his bed. And Thutmose the first has a dream, or he has a thought, you know, everything's good. I think I want an empire. We got to go conquer some people. You know, we have the Super Bowl today and things like that. In the ancient world, it was warfare. And the Bible says, and we know this from antiquity, that the time of going to war in antiquity is when? The spring. Spring is the time of going to war. Why? You get all your planting in, you get all your agriculture, everything's set. Okay, now let's go beat up on people. And so off they go to their Super Bowl for that year. And so this is the way it goes. And so Thutmose the first says, I got to go beat up on some people. So where does he go? Well, he really only has one place to go. I mean, they get the Nubians in the south, and they're always kind of cooperative, but that's where all the Egyptian gold comes from, right? Nubians got so much gold down there, they don't know what to do with it, so the Egyptians are taking it. But the only way to go is north. I mean, you can go north and east into the Levant. You can go into Canaan. You can go into Syria. That's about it. So what does he do? He drives his armies all the way to the Euphrates River. And he sets up a big billboard, big stele, a big piece of rock up there. It says, I am Thutmose the first, king of the world. This is my this is now the official northern border of my kingdom. And he claims it. But But what did he just do? He just crossed into the territory of the Mitanni kingdom, and there's a flashpoint. Now he has to fight the Mitannis, and there's a few skirmishes that go on, but basically Mitanni just kind of hides over the hill, and as the Egyptians go to town by town, and here's the basic line. Go to a town. Would you like to consider yourself a part of the Egyptian empire or perhaps die? And of course, what are you going to say? Oh, yeah, we heard about you guys. Yeah, okay, we're good. And so they would just go. So Tutmosis the first thinks he's got it all nailed down. He thinks he's got him an empire. And so he leaves for home. These people love me, and I'm going to go home. Well, guess what? As soon as he's over the horizon, they're all watching. Okay, he's gone. Here come the Mitannis back. And the Mitannis say, "You did what?" And they said, "Nah, we're kidding. We really love you. We're still in your court. You know, we're happy." So about by the time Tutmosis I gets his army back home, the whole northern thing is in his head. I mean, it's more of the kingdom, the empire is more an imagination than it is a reality. So that's the situation with Tutmosis I. Well, he dies, and now we're going to go father-son. For the rest of the dynasty, father-son. So here's the son, Tutmosis II. And Tutmosis II does the same thing. He's trying to send armies up, and he's trying to control the area, but same thing. You know, I mean, unless you stay up there with a big army and really reinforce it, they're just basically making a show and going back home, and the Mitannis are coming back and taking the... they just want the corridor to the sea. They want that Mediterranean trade. By the way, Egypt has contact with the Mediterranean, so they don't ever have a problem with that. So, but here's the problem. Tutmosis II has a little wife. Her name is Hatshepsut. And little Hatshepsut is not interested in being the queen. She's not interested in being what's called the god's wife, right? Pharaoh's god, so you're the god's wife. She wants to be Pharaoh, not queen. She wants to be Pharaoh of Egypt. And so, interestingly enough, Tutmosis II dies a little prematurely. She's probably slipping a little glass in his oatmeal from time to time, you know, to kind of facilitate the process. And he dies. Well, and she's got this all worked out because the crown prince, when her husband dies, is only 5 years old. So if the crown prince is only 5 years old, she has now the excuse that I will be his guardian and I will rule administratively Egypt in his stead. But she's not happy just kind of ruling. She has monuments built, has a big mortuary temple built for herself. She starts a big project. She shows herself on the monuments with the beard and the male clothing, right? I mean, she depicts herself as the king, as Pharaoh, not as a queen. Now, little Tut III is in the nursery having a good time, and he's totally unaware of all of this. Doesn't care. But eventually, by the time he reaches puberty, by the time he hits, say, age 14 or 15 for sure, he does what every crown prince gets to do. You become the commander of the Egyptian northern army of Amun-Ra, the army responsible for subduing the territories in the north. So, by around 15, he becomes known as the conqueror of Canaan and Syria. Right? And how long does Hatshepsut reign? 20 years. Now stop and think. There have been pharaohs who've come to the throne when they're 12 years old and began to rule immediately. So think of Tutmosis III. He, at five, wasn't ready to rule, but queen, it's not his mother, it's his aunt, Hatshepsut is on the throne in Egypt, ruling Egypt, and he's the commander of the northern army. He's bivouacked with his troops up there somewhere in Canaan in Syria, and at 3 a.m. in his tent, on his cot, he has this thought. I'm sure this is exactly the way it happened. I'm 25 years old. I'm the Pharaoh of Egypt. What am I doing up here?
Time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586. Or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.